when I had a kid, honest to God, I was like, yeah, all right, that makes sense. Like, as out of the blue as it was, I was like, this make, you know, this on my journey as a human being, I can handle this. This is good.
Welcome to The Art of Fatherhood, a podcast that takes you on the journey of fatherhood. Now, here's your host, Art Eddy.
This week's The Art of Fatherhood podcast is being brought to you by Change Toothpaste. I've used Change Toothpaste for a few weeks now, and I'm a fan for many reasons. One is that I've said on my podcast and website that we need to leave this world in a better place for our children and future generations. Change Toothpaste shares that notion, as their toothpaste comes in a tablet form in a compostable pouch and are sent in a 100% recyclable mailer made from recycled newspaper. So all of their packaging can be recycled. Speaking of waste, we all know how hard it is to get toothpaste out of the tube, and obviously you can never get back in the tube, right? Kids and adults can make a mess using that toothpaste tube. Change Toothpaste changes all of that. All you need to do is put a tablet in your mouth, chew it, and start using a wet toothbrush. And another reason why I love Change Toothpaste is because it's easy to travel with. I recently traveled to New York to visit some friends to have a guy's weekend, and I packed Change Toothpaste tablets, and it was much easier. Change Toothpaste comes in three great flavors, spearmint, cinnamon, and bubblegum. All the flavors are not overwhelming, but they give you enough flavor to keep your teeth and mouth smelling fresh. Plus, Change Toothpaste is free of gluten, dairy, nuts, or soy. So anybody having those allergies, you do not need to worry. There are no harsh chemicals, and their product is vegan. So let's take a look at all the benefits. A lot less waste than traditional toothpaste containers, tastes great, and there are no harsh chemicals, and it's easy to travel with when you're on the go. If you want to leave this world in a better place, for our kids and future generations, we need to support companies like Change Toothpaste. They're looking to do their part to keep this world going in the right direction, and now it is up to us as parents to do our part. Make a positive change with Change Toothpaste. Go to changetoothpaste.com for more information and place your order today. Also, when you place your order, make sure you use the discount code ARTOFFATHERHOOD to get additional 15% off your order at checkout. What's going on, everybody? Art Eddy here for another edition of the Art of Fatherhood podcast, and I'm very happy to have the one and only Hal Sparks. Thanks for taking the time to chat with me, sir. How you doing?
My pleasure. I'm doing great. How are you?
Doing really well, man. Looking forward to chatting with you. People obviously know your good work, whether you know, it's music, whether it's TV, producing, whatever the case may be. Your Facebook and YouTube live shows are a hit. I love your comedy. And
thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. And I think it's funny too, and you probably get this a lot. But I loved you in different shows and different roles. Of course, you know, the VH1 shows. But then as I had kids and we started watching like Lab Rats, I'm like,
yeah,
I know that guy. And
right.
Now, like, my kids know you too.
That's
right.
Right.
You get a lot of that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think because of Queer as Folk, like the breadth of my career is kind of hysterical. but the breadth of my career is such that there are now gay parents with either adopted or biological children that know me from Lab Rats, and the kids don't know why the parents know me, and the parents don't know why the kids know me. It's amazing. And they and they're all freaking out at the mall at the same time, and they do this kind of double take, like, what, how do you know him? How do you know him? You know, it's amazing. I mean, and then in the middle, I've got like every like introductory 16-year-old to 19-year-old stoner watching Dude, Where's My Car? And then, you know, running up to me in packs and going, Zoltan, and then running away. So it's awesome. I mean, I have to say, like, I love the work I've been able to do so far. And I'm a huge, like, believer in both pulp and depth. You have to have, you know, art can sustain all, and neither is more important than the other. And sometimes you just need something you could put on for your kids that is, you know, it's positive, but it's not overly preachy, and it's just a, you know, it's a, you know, a short, cute, you know, personal lesson, maybe couched in a lot of jokes and a lot of fun. And that's what Lab Rats was. Every episode is great.
Yeah, man. We'll get to like your acting and just your creative mind and music in a second, but
yeah,
love talking with good guys like yourself about their fatherhood journey. So when you found out you were going to be a dad, what was going through your mind, sir?
Well, it was not a planned thing. So, but you know, I have always, I think I've always bristled at the idea that parenthood changes you, because I had always come at it from the perspective that I want to have kids one day. I know what kind of kids I want to raise. I know what kind of father I want to be. And it's just about getting at it. And while there are unknowns that you can't fathom as a part of it, both emotionally, psychologically, and physically that occur, you can prep yourself at least to have a baseline ethic and personality that you go, okay, what kind of dad do I want to be? Do I, you know, and you can make those decisions beforehand. And I had in a lot of ways over the years, both in just my own journey as a man, but also in reflecting on my relationship with my dad and his relationship with his dad and going, okay, what worked, what didn't. So when I had a kid, honest to God, I was like, yeah, all right, that makes sense. Like, as out of the blue as it was, I was like, this on my journey as a human being, I can handle this. This is good.
Nice. Love it. And I think, you know, you kind of mentioned the lessons you learned from your dad and, you know, the generations before. Talk about some of the values you're looking to instill into your son as you're growing up.
Yeah, the thing in most of the lessons, it's about how to communicate them best so they're understood. Because I think a lot of the lessons, quite frankly, life will teach you anyways. You're just trying to get a jump on the lessons that life is going to teach your kid and try to present them as gently and as constructively as possible so that they don't have to learn them through like the worst kind of harm and heartbreak. You're like, you can set them up to deal with these things. And so there's an element of what I would call baseline kid-friendly stoicism that I bring to my parenting with my kid. And then that gives me the space to be both fun and the authority in the space. Because while I do believe in joking with my kid and being personable and sharing things, gaming together, you know, and watching, you know, movies and TV shows together that are pop culturally linked more to him than they are to me, you know what I mean? Like, I get doing that, but at the same time, without relinquishing the fact that I'm the dad, I'm the father in this situation. And it's important that that stays something, because to me, I think it gives the, you know, your kid a sense of stability beyond that. Like, they don't need another kid in the house. Because they as much as they might try to put on a brave face about stuff, they get scared. You know, my kid, he's 11 and he still gets jump scared sometimes from movies. And so in a way that I don't even know that adults can fathom, when a kid gets a jump scare in a movie or in a situation, it's your whole body reacting because it's lined up with, I'm small, I can't fight back, I'm hungry, I don't know how to fix food. Like all that is stacked inside there, whether they're psychologically aware or not. So as a parent, you have to be like, I'll play in your sandbox, but you got to know also that I can carry the sandbox with you in it 100 miles if there's a problem.
Yeah.
Great. And as long as they know that. Yeah.
Yeah. Great analogy in the fact that, you know, you want to be there for them. You want to be quote unquote their friend, but in a way that they know that like, you're still the dad.
Yeah.
You can come to me and talk. Like I 100% agree with you where it's like, all right, communication is key. And also knowing where they're at too, because sometimes we might forget like, hey, can we watch a show? Or hey, can I listen to the song? And you're like, oh, this song has this word in it or this message in it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But also too, just kind of like making sure that they understand the pitfalls in life, or it doesn't have to be like a tragic pitfall or something that could like, you know, life threatening, but just certain things, like just for an example, my youngest, she wanted a yearbook and she told my wife, but I think she told her when my wife was kind of finishing up some work, right?
Yeah.
So maybe it didn't like digest fully. And then this is the last week of school. And so my oldest got one, my youngest didn't, and she's upset. And I'm like, what's that? And she goes, no one ordered me a yearbook. And I'm like, hey, did you ask us once? Did you ask us twice? And if you did ask us once, were we paying attention? Because you know, sometimes I'm like, hey, did you clean your room? And you don't pay attention because you're playing your Switch. Yeah. I'm like, that's probably what happened. She's like, yeah. Oh. Okay.
Right.
So yeah. It's just letting them, like giving them examples to let them digest things to make it easier for them not to like be like, oh, that's why it happened. Not that my dad is the worst person in the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not having a yearbook. Right.
Right. Yeah. When you look at some of the lessons that, you know, I could tell now where my dad was trying to lead me to based on the surrounding I was in, that he was like, oh boy. Cause I grew up in Kentucky. Then, born in Cincinnati, but only because that was the nearest hospital without chickens in it. And then I grew up in Kentucky. And then when my dad, he moved to Florida first. We spent summers with him down there when my parents were divorced. And then he moved to Chicago and I went to live with him because I just needed to get out of Kentucky. I just couldn't do it anymore. And I, you know, it's like a choice between parents, which is a rough thing for a kid to do, but it was really one of my first selfish decisions because I knew I was that the area around me, the company I was in, the kids I was around were all on sort of a wind down culturally. They were already drinking. They were already, it was really the sticks. Like Peaks Mill, Kentucky is out there. It's nicer now because, you know, car range has improved so much, you know, since the 50s that even the sticks is getting strip malls, right? But, right, it's just not the same thing. But when I was a kid, it was basically Appalachia meets the Depression. He could tell. He was like, all right, this kid's going to need to know what a salad fork is versus a dessert fork if we're ever going to get out of here. And so he would have these kind of funny sit downs with me when I moved to Chicago, where he attempted to culture me, almost forcible culturing of a kid. You know, there's little Pygmalion moments where he was like, you know, tried to get me to wear like these topsider loafers with no socks that all the kids on the North Shore of Chicago wore. And I just like, I can't do it. I was dressed all in black and had my peach fuzz mustache and that kind of stuff, you know. And ultimately, even when I avoided that guidance, even when I knew that that's not what I wanted and he was missing the point, later on, with maybe six, 8 years later, I would go, okay, that's why he was trying to do that for me. Yeah. And because he didn't do it in a way that was dismissive or, you know, putting me down, it was just like a constant serious offering and a serious, like, let's do this. You're going to go to this thing. We're going to buy you. I'll buy you some dark blue topsiders. You don't have to wear the tan ones, but we're going sailing. We're doing this. And so this kind of like coaxing met with, you know, the seriousness of the endeavor, eventually, even if I didn't absorb it at the time, led me to greater strengths later. And so I recognize that now, that I don't grind on the failures if my kid is reticent to do something or is, you know, a little gun shy about an activity or something, because I almost know that whether he does it or not, he's going to reflect on at some point, because of the constant never-ending improvement I'm trying to make in myself and in him, that, oh, that's what Dad was trying to do. Oh, that would have been cool. Yeah, I see what I mean. I should have learned piano when he asked me about it. And I was being a bit of a, you know, kid at that point, which is fine. But now I want to learn piano. Like, it makes sense. You know, those kind of things, you know, my dad tried to get me to pick up the acoustic guitar when I was a kid and I fought it like crazy. And then my mom bought me an electric guitar and I started playing it. That was all it took. Sometimes that's all. Yeah. But yeah, so anyways, that's... Yeah.
No, I love that. And just the idea of like, when we say like, oh man, I sound like my dad or I sound like my mom.
Right.
It's like, they're saying things to you as a kid that now you're repeating because it makes a lot of sense.
Yes. Well, and it occurred to you later because you heard it that way. And it made sense. It took a little while for those seeds to start producing fruit. And so... you're almost on autopilot a little bit because you know it will kind of work in theory. Yep. And it just needs, what you'll find yourself is you'll do those moments and you'll be very aware because you sound exactly like I did that even with my dad and with my kid today. Because my dad used to have this thing when I would kind of stonewall or be quiet when I was trying, when he would try to suggest something to me, I would just kind of like freeze into the space. And my kid was doing the same thing. And I was like, and I pulled back and made kind of a joke about it in the presence of his grandmother. And I could tell he was like a little, like he might be slightly embarrassed by it. So unlike my dad, I drifted another way in the end of that conversation. I took the benefit of what my dad did and tried to get rid of the liability of what my dad did. And that's fine. It's okay to sound like your parents on the stuff that worked and you go, okay, this just needs to be retooled for the modern era. And there's nothing wrong with that in particular. And then as long as you're ending it with a hug and every time you leave, you're saying, I love you, you're good. So yeah, that in and of itself, like I don't mind the moments where I, you know, I'm not 100% original because I'm not trying to reinvent the wheel. I'm trying to raise a man.
I love how you're dropping so many good parenting bombs. I love it.
Thanks.
Talk about something that, I mean, certain response I feel like could go with this answer, with this question, but what is something that your son has taught you either about yourself or about life?
Huh. That's a That's a tough one. I mean, there's some element of patience, perhaps, you know, or it's just like a puzzle that needs to be solved sometimes. You know what I mean? It's like somebody, it's like every so often, it's like you have a Rubik's Cube and you've solved it and you sit it on a shelf on its little thing and it's kind of like you're proud of the fact that you solved it. And then you're walking by one day and it's suddenly somebody mixed it up. And you're like, oh, I gotta solve this again, you know? And then you're like, okay, it's solved. And then the next day it's unsolved again. And that's sort of what parenting is. Just like little, and it's and you get patterns after a while so you can solve it quicker, right? Because the reason you put it up there was because you were proud of yourself for solving the Rubik's Cube. It took a lot. And then these people who can solve it behind their backs or whatever, these are the parents in Pottery Barn catalogs. You're like, who the hell are these people? I don't buy it, right? And
They're
that's
the ones that put the like my students is an honor roll like on the back of the
yeah.
van, right?
Well, you know, there is an interesting thing, and I as a obvious fan of pop culture, which I see behind you, and it's why immediately I have immense respect for you as a human being.
Thank you.
There was an article about cosplay that said that people act more morally when they are cosplaying than when they are dressed in their normal street clothes. Not because they're dressed as a superhero, even if they're dressed as Darth Vader. They will behave nicer and finish tasks that are more positive than they would if they weren't doing that. So an element of costuming is part of our function as humans. There's something about it that does this. So that leans me in the direction, like, I used to be wholly against the idea of uniforms in school. And now I'm like, you know, as long as you can wear whatever you want when you're not at school, a uniform at school isn't such a bad idea. Okay, I can work with that. Gym clothes, we all had gym clothes, right? That's the softball version of it, right? You had to buy the school shorts and the school tank top, right? But you could wear your regular street clothes to school and that kind of thing. But everybody had the same outfit when you're playing in gym. Those elements of it, and when you put those stickers on a car, it's as much a reminder to the kid every time they get in the car as it is a brag on the other parents. Because you can also see that families that often do that can be the snippiest parents sometimes. They can be a bit, you know, right? They're the ones yelling at their kid in Safeway, you
Yep.
know? And it's part of their thing. That is the carrot and stick. I will show off when you do something good, but if you veer off the reservation a little too much, you're going to get a wallop in some form or fashion, emotionally, intellectually, psychologically, or whatever. But so I have the a very I used to think, like, even the pictures of like all the Calvin and Hobbes kids and the families or Peanuts or whoever that represent the whole family, that kind of stuff. I was like, what is that? And yet part of it is, as a parent, you're like, okay, how can I tourniquet and tie off the worst parts of this problem where I can get a handle on it so that the more complex parts I have some energy left over for? Because that's really what it is. I mean, a lot of parenting is energy, you know, manipulation
Yep.
and sort of a, you know, finding, you know, pacing yourself, you know, where you to not get too caught up in a problem where you're emotionally exhaust yourself about something that isn't going to matter ultimately, but also not letting stuff slide because you're too exhausted to deal with something.
Yeah.
And that's a huge balance, you know. And it's like, you ever see those like fair games where people have a spoon in their mouth and there's an egg on it and they have to run across a field without dropping the egg, and they're doing it as fast as possible. Okay, being a parent is like living in the spoon, trying to not get crushed by the egg, like you're super tiny, like ant size, and in slow motion the egg is just rolling back and forth, like it takes a 1,000 years for them to cross the field. So every shift, you know, you're like, okay, we back away from this right now because the egg's coming down. All right, we'll try to, you know, and everything looks like a crisis, but ultimately you're getting relatively smooth. If you back out and you have a macro view of it, you're actually moving with some speed and some smoothness. But every crucial moment seems so exaggerated, you know. So yeah.
Yeah, and also too, just going back to the uniform thing, if you
Yeah.
think about it, right? Like from a parent's perspective and a kid's perspective, how easy, because the kids are like, oh, so and so is wearing the latest kicks or, you know, has the latest top or something like that. you level out the game feel, because it's like, here's this school issued polo or t-shirt or whatever.
That's what solved it.
And you don't have to worry about like, oh, what are they going to wear tomorrow? Or man, you watch this, you know what they're wearing Monday through Friday, right?
That's right. Well, it worked for Einstein, and he didn't exert any effort intellectually, you know, right? He had five outfits and a sweater he wore all weekend, and then a fresh set of clothes. Same outfit, same clothes, never thought about it, just put it on. And to some degree, his thought form about that came from the same root of putting kids in uniforms in schools, because you're not thinking about that part of it. You don't have, there's no, all the social pressure aspect of who's got better clothes and all that kind of stuff is taken out of the equation. And that's exhausting, especially for a developing brain, mm-hmm. you know? So that's, and then there's, you know, the hyper libertarian aspect of like, they should be able to whatever, you know, like we're, you know, it's almost like kids should make up their own lessons plans and just put them in a room and that. No, all those dumb ideas have been tried, and they are retried every day via poverty.
Yeah,
they really are. Like people without resources, people without schools, people without the, you know, the necessary caloric intake for their children are always doing the, by accident, by default, what would be a dip experiment in a modern society.
Yeah.
And so my thing is like, all right, we've got some things that are tried and true, just socially, parentally, personally with kids that you know will work because they've worked for generations. Try to raise your kid to be a decent human being.
Yep.
And there's that constant walking balance between making your kid kind, but not nice where they're walked on. And that's, you know, that's the bounce back and forth. And it's, you know, with girls, it's an entirely different strategy. I don't have a daughter, but I raised a friend of mine's daughter till she was six. So I was I was the man in her life crucial window.
Yeah.
And, you know, I noticed the natural differences between the two of them, which will not, you know, as you get older, those narrow, but at a baseline, when you're little, they're enormous. And especially as you go through, you know, puberty, it spikes as well. And so knowing what you have to manage and knowing that other societies, history is full of attempts to solve these problems.
Yep.
Armies and poetry, you know, and maiden groups where they do each other's hair and that kind of stuff for, you know, girl cliques and that kind of stuff, and boy cliques where everybody dresses up in the exact same outfit and tries to keep it as clean as possible. Basically, you're trying to develop the best qualities of who they are and slice off the parts that are naturally going to be a problem, you know? Yes. So, yeah. And that's, and as a parent, you can only, you know, I think it's like an 80-20 rule. Some people say 50-50, but I think you're 80% responsible for who your kid turns out to be. 20% it will be their free will for the rest of their lives, you know, and that's up to them. That will expand as they become an adult.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No doubt. One more question before we kind of go into some other things. Is there a dad hack or a piece of advice you'd offer to new dads?
Yeah. Well, first of all, you will find that parents are lying to you about the whole, oh my God, we're exhausted and there's so much going on. They just don't want to come to your stupid party. And they now have a brand new excuse. They use the child as a way of not going to your stupid party that they didn't want to, they don't want to hang out with you. And now they're like, well, the baby's a little, you know, and you're like, meanwhile, you see him at the store by themselves, like I needed time away. Right. But they couldn't get it. So, what I would say is, when it comes to parenting is, the best thing for me, and I think that's worked so far, is that I created a strategy for my kid when he misbehaves, which was that if he does something wrong to someone in particular, what I have him do is I call him out on it. I tell him that was wrong. That's not a good thing to do over. And I want you to go over to them and I want you to apologize and tell them what you're apologizing for. I'm sorry I did this and it was wrong. And then come back to me, tell me what they said when you said that, And then I say, I love you, and give them a hug. And that was just the strategy. Like, cause I mean, kids go through little, you know, biting, kicking phases when they're toddlers. When they get to be 4, 5, 6 years old, they start venturing out and feeling frustrated because they can be hungry or sleepy and not in charge of when they eat or sleep. And that's a difficult, like, look at adults. Like, the fact that adults can be hangry is madness to me. Like, grow the hell up. But like, a child is that way, of course, because they're not, you're not going to sleep until there's something soft to lay on and somebody, one of these big people, puts you in it. Yeah. And so they've got a reason to be frustrated. So you got to understand that. But at the same time, you want to let them know that there are certain behaviors that you try to share with other people to show your discomfort that are not of quality and are not acceptable. Yeah. So anyways, that's the strategy. Like, tell your kid they did something wrong, make them aware of it, tell them to go apologize to the person, have them, and for why they're doing it, that's crucial. Come back to you, say, after you're done, come back to me, tell me what they said to you. And that's a really crucial thing, because it means them listen to the other person, say, well, thank you very much, and that's why I was hurt, and I really love the fact that you came over and apologized and very dignified and blah, blah, blah. Like, that's what most will say. Or if they're a dick about it, you can also have that conversation. You can go, he was mean to me. Like, well, you kicked him in the shin and he's not a nice person. And that's how some people are going to react. Doesn't mean you're a bad person. You did the right thing. You were wrong in the first place. You apologized. You said what you did. And that's on them from that point on. And then you can, but you always end it with a hug and I love you. And that in and of itself builds that responsibility without like going, well, he's a little crazy. He gets a little, no, he doesn't get a little. He gets in control of himself. Yeah, no.
Boys will be boys, right?
No. You know, yeah. And as a Freemason, I've been like, my grandfather was one and I am one. I'm very aware that men need structure, or our baser instincts will run away with us in general society. And so I'm, you know, that part of it, you got, like, most of us are finding a way to put a bit in the mouth of testosterone so it doesn't run wild.
Yep.
And that, you know what I mean? That's it. That's, and that, and when you're raising a boy, that's what you're teaching him to do, is like, over the next 6 years, you're going to go through your teen years, you're going to be full of testosterone, and it's going to make a lot of decisions for you. It still does when you're an adult. So what you're going to want to do is make yourself aware of that and the choices you have to meet that need. And what you will do is take the most dignified, you know, and quality choice you can make and still get your needs met, of the multitude. And if you only think there's one solution, you're wrong. There's lots of them. So giving them that multitude of things, you know, you don't have to be an adrenaline junkie and try a squirrel suit just because you're a little bored right out of the gate.
Great piece of advice. And I love the fact, the thing that you set up with your son, the structure where it's like, okay, just don't say you're sorry and walk off and be like, all right, it's cool. But there's so many different things that you guys are creating, and the line of communication between you two is just chef's kiss. So well done on that, sir. I appreciate that. From acting to music to stand-up comedy to a bunch of everything, like all the stuff that you do, what kind of drew you into the world of entertainment?
I grew up without a television in Kentucky. And my mom, instead of daycare, used to drop me off at the movie theater in town because we knew the theater owner at Brighton Park Mall in Frankfurt. And I would sit there and watch the same two movies over and over until she was done with work. She's a nurse. And they had two theaters there. And I would help Mr. Payne, the dude who ran the theater, put the platters up on the projector, and then he would just let me sit there, and I'd have a little money for popcorn, and then I would play in the arcade in between screenings, and that was my day, basically. And I was a huge, like, Kiss fan. Bought my first Kiss album when I was 5 years old with my own money. It was the only thing I wanted to buy. Bought it at a flea market and in Friendship, Indiana. And there was elements of like sitting and listening to records, and then going to the movies and seeing Star Wars and Raiders and going, I would love to be an archaeologist swinging around with a whip and all this kind of stuff. And I would love to be a space pirate with a laser gun. And I was like, that guy gets to do both. That's really amazingly fun. That's crazy. So Harrison Ford was sort of an inspiration that it could be a job, not just those characters, right, that inspired me. And I would, as a big Kiss fan, I listened to the interviews with the guys, you know, whenever I could see them. And they talked a lot about, you know, being appreciative of fans and really focusing on the work and trying to make sure the shows were great so that everybody has a great time. And, and that sort of lesson of like making people feel good as a mission is a fantastic thing. And so I just clicked with that idea, but I didn't know how to do it. And then when I went to Chicago, Chicago is it's a blue collar arts town. There's no bullshit. It's not magic. Nobody taps you on the shoulder and like, you got moxie, kid. You want to be in pictures? Like, it doesn't happen. It's really it's a ladder. I mean, you might as well work on an assembly line. And even as a stand-up, when I was 14 years old, I was like, how does stand-up work? Like, well, you do open mics and then you host and then you middle and then you headline and then you tour. I'm like, all right, I'll do that then. Like, it's, yeah. Okay. That's what it works. You know, it's like, first you work the pumps, then you work the floor, then you work the cash register, then you work in the shop, right? Like, okay. And the same thing with like acting. It was like, you know, classes, practice, theater, television, film, and then whatever else. And then a mix of the thing. And then it's about the quality of the work and the quantity of the work after a certain amount of time. Okay, I'll do that. And the same thing with music, like, you know, if you can play your instrument, and I grew up in, you know, my dad plays bluegrass and my mom played auto harp when I was growing up. And so like in my family, the only rule is you have to be able to play. If you have an instrument, you have to be able to play it well. Don't just flop around on it. Work on it because the instrument deserves it. Somebody spent time making that thing and they didn't do it just so you could go, you know, three chords and forget about it. Yeah. So nice. Right. There's work. My dad's a luthier. He does like fret work for people on the side. He's an architect, but he does that. He does it for like Sam Bush and Bela Fleck and all these bluegrass guys. Okay. Yeah. He set up Sam's his mandolin that Gibson made. My dad did the setup on it and they lasered the frets to see what he had done and then recreated the frets on the mandolin to my dad's specs, that kind of stuff. So, but the idea is that like he puts thought into those things. Like he spends time making an instrument sound right. You should put time into bringing whatever music is in you out. Nice. And that was it. And they're all valuable. They all serve a purpose and they all, you know, I think bring, you know, light, beauty and joy to the world. And that's something we're always going to be short of because I'm a realist.
Yeah. No doubt, man. Thank you very much for sharing that. And
yeah,
is there a role or a gig or anything that, I mean, you've accomplished a lot in all different mm-hmm. facets, but is there something that maybe you're most proud of just because of where you're at or how long it took you to get something? I mean, sometimes I interviewed Dietrich Bader a few weeks ago.
Love him. He's a good dude.
And he was talking about how he got a role really quickly and then like, he kind of like, didn't work as hard and kind of squandered the money. And then I was like, all right, now I'm the struggling actor. But then it's like, he learned the value of like, nothing comes easy. Right.
Even yeah.
the first gig. So it can be whatever, you know, anything in your career, but is there something that means the most to you just because of like where you're at in life? And I know it's tough because there's a lot of different, you know, parts of your life and your career where things mean a lot, but is there one that kind of sticks out?
On the one hand, I see my career as a giant mass that is heading in one direction, like a blob that's floating through space-time going in one direction. And my goal as an actor has always been to be Burgess Meredith or Hume Cronin. I want to be the old guy in the movie. That's my thing. I want to be like the, oh my God, that guy's still alive. Not, you know, 95 years old playing the wizened old grandfather character or whatever. That's my goal. That's when I think my Oscar will come, for example. Like I probably will win one beforehand, but but in all honesty, my arc has been, I'm going to do this my whole life, like George Burns. So I'm in no hurry. It's about like getting good marks on the board. Like, okay, did it. Like somebody called me like TV veteran Hal Sparks in a article they wrote about me, like not even an interview. They just did that. And I was like, look at that. That 90s Hal would be amazed at that because I called the 90s the Sisyphus years.
Okay.
Just roll every career point, roll the rock up and it would roll right back down. Every good thing that happened collapsed. And the only thing besides me being amazingly talented and fun to work with, that got me through it was the fact that I recognized that every time I auditioned, it was the same guys in the room because there was a type and there were only a few working guys. And a few of them started working pretty regularly. And eventually I was like, it's like a Pez dispenser. At some point, these guys are all going to be busy. And I'm the only guy who's been in here a bunch of times and they're calling me back. So they definitely like me. They just don't know where to put me yet. And eventually they're just going to run out at, you know, they're going to have an empty hole. And I'm going to, even if I'm a square peg, they're going to like, all right, well, we got to fill it with something. So I never thought it would be easy. Like I'm always amazed when people go, oh, it's tough. I'm like, it should be. You're in people's living rooms. Like it should be hard to walk into every American's living room. Right. That should be difficult. You should have to prove yourself a little bit, you know, because I don't want when you aren't proven, you're kind of a mess. So, and you can wreck other people. So once I hit Talk Soup, I got that. There's like 5,000 people up for that. And I'd been auditioning for it for 5 years. I never thought I was going to get it because they were such dicks that I was like, they just keep auditioning everybody and they're just punting them. They don't know what they want. It's almost like I was embarrassed to be there when I got the job almost because I was like, you know, I wasn't like, I'm not going to get my hopes up, but I'm going to do the best job. I'm going to do a job. I'm going to walk in on this audition and do the job. I'm not going to do like, this is how I'd kind of think about, no. This is how I would do the job on day one. Yeah. And it will be of quality or better than anything that's been there, or I won't show up. I jokingly, and I do this everywhere I go, and some actors I've worked with are a bit off-put by it because I think the value of confidence outweighs any kind of artificial humility where people are like, well, I don't, and most of the people who I know who are artificially humble are actually diva-esque and rude to people. So I'd rather just be confident and let you know right out of the gate. But when I go into like a store or something like that, and people ask me how they are, I'm like, how are you? I'm like, awesome. And they're like, oh, I never heard that before. I hear that. And they constantly respond. And my response is, well, if you're not awesome, why leave the house and inflict that on anybody?
Yes.
Nice. You know what I mean? Why would I, if I'm not feeling great, I'm not going to tell it. I'm not going to, you don't even know I'm here. I'm just going to go walk, skulk in, buy what I need and leave. But if you're talking to me and I'm responding, I want to make your day better. And art, even when it hurts, does that. Yep. And so I can go through periods, you know, it was like a, you know, 3 years in the desert after Queer as Folk, arguably, where my agents were like, well, you're never going to work again. The big gay show ruined it for everybody. Like they were literally convinced that, and they weren't wrong to be convinced of this because that's what they were hearing.
Yeah.
From, not just like some producers are like, well, that was a bit much for me, but also the like gay casting directors who were like, well, I can't see past it. So I'm not going to know. And they wouldn't even see me for a long time. And there was effectively wandering the desert for a few years. And a lot of my co-stars panicked about that aspect. We were all in sort of the same boat. And as a stand-up, I've always had that. I can always reinvent myself. I can always deliver alone with a microphone. It's all I need. And that's always been the safety that allows me to be patient about every other aspect of my career. It's been great.
Nice. Love it. One more question before we finish off with the Fatherhood Quick Five. Out of the different, you know, things that you're into, whether it is your different bands or stand-up comedy or acting, is there one, and this is gonna, I'm not trying to be trite, but like, is there one where you just kind of like get in the zone and not lose yourself, but you just feel more like free, like you can just, is there one profession?
No, they're all like that or I wouldn't do it.
Okay.
If I couldn't get into that state in whatever I'm doing, I'm not doing that thing.
Nice.
Because I don't have any business doing it. You know what I mean? Like I'm sure if I put 10 years in, I could be a great tap dancer and lose myself in the power of tap dancing. But that's not going to happen anytime soon. And I'm not going to find it naturally. but writing music, singing, playing guitar, doing stand up and disappearing into a role as an actor, or in some ways, I would say in Donald Davenport, appearing in a role, because you know the only difference between me and Donald Davenport really is $1 billion, and I really am that confident. And so all of them have to have that or I don't do the thing. Anything I'm engaged in, I want to lose myself in it. You know, singing in particular, it's interesting because singing's the most reliant on biological elements where if you blow your voice or you can't hit the note or you're fatigued or acid reflux or you're not getting enough sleep or enough water. There's 100 reasons why singing can be more of a chore even than guitar playing. I mean, it helps to warm up and it helps to stretch out, but a lot of people could play an hour long set on guitar with most stuff if you're not playing like Damage Incorporated or Battery from Master of Puppets over and over and over again. You could probably do it for about an hour and a half without any major problems. But singing in and of itself is one of those things, and it's why I'm always impressed by singers with longevity, is one of those things where it requires a lot of calculation inside the performance. Okay. If you're not naturally gifted with some sort of like magic throat. And even those folks, after a while, it gets calculated really quick after a while because they don't want to lose it. Yep. And in doing that, that was the hardest area for me to lose myself in it, to lose my, to release the tension and all the stuff around making sure I hit the notes and the rhythm of the song and especially on high notes. That it took me a while. It took me like it was, it, and I would, it was mistakes. I ruined my voice at one point where I was like, I might not ever speak again even. So it was really scary. And then I was like, look, there's somebody singing who's really old, who sounds amazing. What are they doing? I'll just do that. And that helped immensely. But now, like I do the ultimate jam night at the Whiskey with some regularity and they just throw songs at you and nobody rehearses. You just do them live and it's amazing. And I hosted it a couple weeks ago and my band is opening for them tonight.
Nice.
And I do a variety of songs from Soundgarden to Prince to, Queen to, Alice in Chains, whatever. And I can, my voice can handle all those things and I'm very happy about that. But it was calculated. It was work to make sure that I stayed in that. And so I decided that at the jam, I would find my way to lose my mind in songs again. So as a singer, letting those things go and just being in the song is now the work.
Nice.
For me.
Love it. Yeah. Again, just talking with you and you know, you were saying earlier about like teaching, to be kind, but also, not to be walked on. There is that part where it's like, you gotta believe in yourself.
Yeah.
No one else is going to believe in you. You gotta believe in yourself. So I love that answer.
And it will always be harder. The world is always trying to chip away at your confidence. There's nothing, you need to always do everything you can to reinforce your self-awareness and your confidence because the world has no investment. No one else has any investment in you having it except your parents and your intimate partner. And sometimes that ebbs and flows. So, but in those alone moments, it will be your opinion of yourself that matters. And so you need to work on your opinion of yourself all the time because the world will always be like drive by slitting you with a small blade, and you gotta have thick skin.
Yep. No doubt. You gotta watch out for like the Pet Sematary where the kid is hitting Herman Munster, right? With the
yes. That's right.
Thank you very much for sharing that. We're gonna finish off the Fatherhood Quick Five. Favorite movie you guys watching right now. Do you have one?
Favorite movie we're watching together right now. There's a couple. We used to watch Goldmember. Austin Powers, like last summer especially, we were watching Goldmember regularly, and it became a thing to where he wants to watch it when his grandmother's watching him, and she's like, ugh, I hate this, we watch Captain America First nice. Avenger together. Because I love that movie and I think the lesson in it is great,
You're talking about the scene when before he gets the serum, right?
Yes, where he jumps on the grenade and he's just he's self-sacrificing to a point that's genuine, but it shows who his character is and that's what makes him worthwhile.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that movie is made from that grenade scene and then also the schnapps scene where they're having the schnapps and
I don't have a drink. I'm going to save it tomorrow. I have a drink now. I'm not having a procedure. Just save me any of that schnapps. Not as much as I should have. Which is interesting because that would have been Steve Rogers' last drink because he can't get drunk.
Yeah. Love it. Fun fact from Hal. I love it. Favorite family song, or is there a band you couldn't wait to introduce your son to?
Oh, well, obviously Kiss. And my kid fell in love with I Was Made for Loving You. You know, which, you know, it's lighter drums, and I understand that. I'm looking forward to introducing him to Weird Al. He's definitely knows who he is, but he's entering that age where it'll really quit. Cause I think it's like 11, 12, 13 is the real window where you get Weird Al, the subtlety and the humor and the variety and that kind of stuff. So that's yeah, for sure.
Love it. Describe the perfect family vacation. Where would it be?
Oh, well, that's an issue. Because I like snow and my girl likes beach. So it would have to be, you know, Los Angeles, you know, which is where we are anyway. So, we just have to we'll go to Big Bear, and then, you know, we'll go to the beach in the day, and then we'll go night ski in Big Bear. But, ultimately, if I could just like grab my kid and go, you know, on a father son trip someplace.
Yeah.
There are areas in like, Scotland and Ireland and even like Norway, Austria would be great. Places where there's like huge mountains and rolling hills, and just like the geography is awe-inspiring.
Yeah.
And the culture is familiar but new.
Yep.
And a variety of that, I think, will be part of it. That's my goal for when he turns like 15. Is he and I are going to go to Europe.
That's awesome.
And spend like a month, you know, going to a few places. One of the big turning points in my life happened in France. So I want to bring him there. When I was 14, that's where I made the decision to move to Chicago. I was in Monaco, actually.
Yeah.
On a school trip that I'd gotten a scholarship for, cause that was me and one of the other poor kids got to go for half price. So my grandparents kicked up the money and I was able to go. And then once they always say, how do you keep them down on the farm once they've seen Gay Paris? Absolutely true. Literally played out in my life, because I saw what was out there in this giant, beautiful, crazy world. And I was like, I can't stay. I got to see it. It's got to, you know, so I want to give him that, and it'll be his choice what to do with it.
Nice. Love it. Favorite video game to play with him right now is what?
Oh, Gang Beasts.
And lastly, top three words you hope your son would use to describe you as a dad. What would you want them to be?
Sincere, loving, and strong.
Great three words right there. And, you know, you talked about the acting. You just want to keep being that blob. And you mentioned Burgess Meredith. If they ever do a remake of Grumpy Old Men, I would love to see you do Burgess Meredith's role.
Exactly. I look at some of the stuff Alan Arkin has done in like the last two decades, and I'm like, I just love his free, silly, oldish humor. He's just a, you know, little past middle age, older dude. And it's so, that's the great thing about comedy, is because you're always introduced to a new era of comedy in your own life, because different things will make you laugh, and different things, you can bring different things to laughter as a performer. You're not going to make the same jokes when you're 50 is when you're 20, and you shouldn't necessarily. Yep. So, and that's a good thing, you know, and you can always, my thing about comedy is you can always be funnier. There's always room for something that's got there it is, you know, to joke. Right. And it's, yep. And it's that tickle that's sort of magical that occurs when you do something that's genuinely funny, and it'll happen along the way. But each one, as you add more life, because like I said, life is a struggle. As you go through more of that struggle, that tickle of laughter becomes more meaningful and more powerful. So, you know, in many ways, old laughs are the best.
Yeah, no doubt. Love it. People, make sure you follow Hal on Twitter at Hal Sparks, and go to his website, halsparks.com. Thank you so much for your time. You're very generous.
I wish
your family continued success. And again, this was great. I love your take and your views on fatherhood, because I think they're fantastic.
That's great.
Fantastic. So thanks.
Well, one of these days, my kid can do it. We'll do a review, like one of those things where they follow kids for 10 years. You know what I mean? Like, all right, let's watch this. You can listen to this with me and go, well, all right. Yeah, I see what you were doing. And it was pretty good, Dad.
Nice.
It was all right. Yeah. Thanks so much. I got to go catch a plane.
All right.
Thanks for checking out this week's edition of the Art of Fatherhood podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. I also want to say a big thank you to this week's sponsor, Change Toothpaste. Not only looking to make the environment better by eliminating a lot of waste when it comes to toothpaste, but they have a lot of great flavors that you and your kids can enjoy. So make sure you support the people who are supporting me here at the Art of Fatherhood by going to changetoothpaste.com for more information on their products and place your order today. And don't forget the discount code Art of Fatherhood to get an additional 15% off your order. And also go to artoffatherhood.net. You can have a chance to check out some great articles like the weekly Dad's Doing It Right column, the Collector of the Week, and many more. Plus, you have a chance to win some very cool prizes like video games, collectibles, all that good stuff. Go to artoffatherhood.net, and please make sure you rate, subscribe, and review wherever you listen to podcasts, because I'll greatly appreciate it to get the word out on the Art of Fatherhood podcast. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Art of Fatherhood podcast. Leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts and go to artoffatherhood.net.